So what are the chances a jobs bill makes it through the Senate?
I don't know, Steve. What are the chances I'm going to get $1 million today?
A million? Maybe $5.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Happy Friday. It's October 21st.
Coming up, can the Fed do even more to help the housing market?
European leaders say they'd have a debt crisis planned by Sunday. Today, they ask, how about Wednesday?
And baby boomers rejoice. There could be a license plate that celebrates your generation.
Those stories ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
There was another attempt at getting a jobs bill through the U.S. Senate, and another filibuster sent the bill to defeat. After failing to get President Obama's near $500 billion American Jobs Act past a GOP filibuster earlier, Senate Democrats tried to push one plank of it through that would have sent money to states for teaching, firefighting, and first responder jobs. But Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports the outcome was the same, though there may be some other options.
Following this defeat, Democrats plan to bring forward other items in the president's jobs agenda, like infrastructure spending, payroll tax cuts, and help for the unemployed. Helping the states prevent layoffs is popular with voters, especially public sector union voters. But it doesn't play well with Republicans. They argue that more deficit spending and higher taxes on the wealthy to save public sector jobs in the short term could actually harm private sector job creation in the long term. Outplacement expert John Challenger says all those laid-off teachers and government administrators may prove a drag on the job market for a while.
Employers in the private sector worry that people coming out of the public sector don't have the same kind of urgency to get the job done, that they've been in more comfortable, safer jobs for the longer period of time.
Since March 2010, the private sector's added nearly 2.5 million jobs. Over the same period, the government has shed more than 500,000 jobs. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Let's get some analysis on what another jobs bill failure in the Senate means to Wall Street and to the rest of the U.S. economy. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large at CBS Money Watch, and she's with us now from New York, as she is every Friday morning. Hi, Jill.
Good morning.
Does this really mean that there's going to be nothing on jobs? I mean, tax cuts perhaps? I mean, is Congress going to bail?
I don't think so. I think Congress may do something on the margins. Look, we've got 25 million Americans who are unemployed, marginally attached, or working part-time for economic reasons. You know, a lot of those 25 million Americans are voters, too. I don't think that escapes Congress.
If we're at this partisan stalemate, Jill, what can happen in the Congress? What can they do?
I think that it really will be sort of smaller things at the margin, maybe extending that payroll tax cut, maybe extending unemployment benefits. Interesting, though, I think the economic impact will be limited. But, you know, funny, the market impact has really been muted on this news because investors have really low expectations on the job creation front. Europe continues to be the pressure point from the investor perspective.
All right. Well, so let's talk about Europe then for a moment. I know France and Germany say they're going to delay any certain proposal to address the debt crisis there. They had this Sunday as a deadline saying we're going to come up with a plan by Sunday. And now it's Wednesday of next week. They seem to be moving the goalpost, right?
Yeah. And I keep thinking about Lucy holding the football and kind of whiffing when Charlie Brown comes to try to kick it. And, you know, a lot of people keep saying, look, why do we care about this? What's so important? And here's the issue. U.S. banks have very close ties to the European banking system, particularly the German, the French and the U.K. banks. How close? Well, the Congressional Research Service estimates that U.S. banks have loan exposure to German and French banks in excess of, get this, $1.2 trillion.
Wow.
A collapse of a Eurozone bank would have a direct negative impact on the U.S. financial system. I think it potentially brings us back to the fall of 2008.
Thanks. Jill Schlesinger at CBS Money Watch.
Take care.
And more about the European debt, by the way, in our global perspective coming up in just a few moments.
But now let's get to the housing market. In the last few days, a couple of top officials from the Federal Reserve have been suggesting the central bank could do even more to boost home buying. For details, let's bring in our regular Friday guest, Chris Lowe of FTN Financial. He is with us from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Chris, first tell us what these Fed officials are talking about doing.
Well, yeah, that's right. This latest one came from Fed Governor Dan Turillo, who spoke in New York City last night. The topic of the speech was unemployment and what the Fed can do. And basically, after emphasizing just how big the problem is, he drilled down to saying the one thing the Fed probably can do is drive mortgage rates lower, get the housing market going again, and hopefully get some jobs there.
But aren't mortgage rates already at historic lows right now?
They are at historic lows, and you know, this is one of the things where we're all looking at this speech saying, okay, so now what? Push rates to 3.5, and maybe you'll get some refi activity. The problem is, though, that an awful lot of people would like to refinance their loans already, but either don't have enough equity to do it or can't get approval from the banks.
Yeah, that's right. The banks aren't lending to a lot of people. Chris, what about the other argument here, which is that, you know, we've had some inflation figures come out this week. They're not very significant, but they're not insignificant. Is there an argument to be made that the Fed shouldn't be doing anything right now?
Well, there is. And in fact, Turillo himself mentioned this. There's a pretty clear link between the Fed's easing in the last couple of years and the waves of inflation, three of them, that we've had since 2008. So one thing he did say is that if the Fed's going to try and push mortgage rates lower, they're going to wait until inflation is lower first. So none of this is going to happen unless inflation drops to 1% or so.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial, thanks so much as always.
You're welcome. Thank you.
General Electric said today its profit rose by more than half, by 57% in the last quarter, helped by higher revenues in its transportation and energy businesses.
The Wall Street Journal says Groupon plans to raise as much as $621 million in its initial public offering, less than the company originally hoped for. The Daily Deal company is expected to hit the road next week to talk to potential investors.
A little later, McDonald's earnings heat up like a apple pie, and Mickey D's gets into the entertainment business. Sort of. That's coming up. Don't forget, you can check out the numbers anytime at our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
And now the Marketplace global perspective. Efforts in Europe to solve the debt crisis are in disarray at the moment. Germany and France say they won't be able to bridge their differences in time for a summit this weekend. So the two countries are calling a second meeting next week and pushing their grand plan deadline back a few days. Reporter Christopher Worth has more from London.
One of the biggest sticking points dividing Germany and France, how big will losses be on bad Greek debt? Germany wants banks and other private investors to take a bigger hit. France believes that will make problems worse. At the same time, the two countries remain divided over whether the European Central Bank should be used to increase the power of the Eurozone's Financial Stability Fund. But as European leaders dither, Cinzia Alcidi of the Center for European Policy Studies says this time there's no room for mistakes.
If there is delay and in the end the solution that is proposed is considered as insufficient, then we could find ourselves again in a situation of extremely high pressure.
And by high pressure, she means that borrowing costs for countries like Italy and Spain will rise immediately and threaten the stability of the Eurozone. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Let's get some analysis now about what's happening in Europe. Nick Davey is a banking analyst with UBS. He's with us now from London. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what's the reaction there in Europe to the fact that these leaders have pushed back the deadline to release this grand plan to deal with the debt crisis?
I would say there's extreme uncertainty in the marketplace at the moment. Don't forget that it was only about 2 weeks ago that we were promised a bazooka solution this weekend that would incorporate all of the things the market is currently uncertain about, namely the level of contribution from the private sector and the restructuring in Greece. Secondly, to what extent the European banking universe needed to be recapitalized. And thirdly, to what extent the European bailout fund should or could be increased. Now, we are, I would say, 2 days before the supposed revelation of this grand plan, and we're no closer, really, to understanding the details behind it.
And I imagine that all of this uncertainty is particularly worrying for some of these countries that are sort of on the edge, like Italy, Spain, Portugal, places like that.
You're right. That being said, I mean, there are some glimmers of hope out there. Specifically here at UBS, we like and put forward the Nordic banks.
Norway you're talking about.
Exactly. The Norwegian banks specifically, I think, are in an extreme safe haven, extreme levels of wealth, low sovereign debt to GDP, exactly the kind of metrics that the Eurozone is lacking.
And of course, Norway is not part of the euro.
Exactly. So not part of the euro, crucially. And second of all, has a banking system which hasn't bought into the eurozone.
I'm curious, are there any places within the euro that people think are safe?
Very little at the moment. I mean, contagion risk is really seen as a problem. The eurozone interconnectedness, I think, spooks the market, certainly during a period of political indecision. So at the moment, core eurozone, I think, remains an extremely difficult place to be. We here at UBS prefer areas outside of the eurozone, the UK to an extent, but certainly Norway and Sweden as well.
Nick Davey, a banking analyst at UBS, joining us from London. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
Riot police in Melbourne, Australia, broke up an Occupy Wall Street protest today, dragging demonstrators out of a plaza there. In Seattle, far from being dragged out of their home base, protesters are being offered free or discounted goods and services from local businesses. Vanessa Romo of station KPLU has more.
It's 5 o'clock in Seattle's Westlake Park, the heart of the local Occupy Wall Street movement. Brad Tutmark pulls up and gets out of his car with two free pizzas. Suddenly, he's surrounded by a crowd of protesters looking for a slice.
So you guys can have the pizza.
Yeah,
so there we go. There you go.
It's for you guys.
Tutmark works for local pizzeria Big Mario's. It's been providing pizzas for the protesters for about a month.
Oh, I'm definitely part of the 99%.
David Meinert owns Big Mario's. He says small businesses like his are suffering because they can't get bank loans and credit. To show his solidarity, Meinert gave away pizzas during the first week of the protest. That's now morphed into discount on pies ordered on behalf of the occupiers. An alliance of small businesses around the country are making similar donations to their local protests. But is it really all for the cause or just good marketing?
It's not super profitable for us. You know, it might be some positive marketing in a way, but it's really just a support.
Back at Westlake Park, protesters like David Smith dismiss the idea their movement is being co-opted by commercial interests.
I've gone to Big Mario's before, but I'm not going to go more often just because they've been donating pizzas.
They would, however, like a few more toppings. In Seattle, I'm Vanessa Romo for Marketplace.
Well, now to West Sussex, England, Steve, where last week an assistant to actor John Travolta called a local KFC to try to reserve a table for Travolta and his friends. She wanted to
wait, KFC?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, she pulled this old Hollywood trick where you call up and you go, Mr. Travolta would like a table, please. And the KFC employee who took the call, I don't know whether she knew who she was dealing with, but said no. Travolta would have to wait in line just like everyone else. Which brings me to two lessons that this assistant needs to learn.
Yeah.
One, you don't have to make reservations at KFC.
Okay, well, that's right.
And two, most importantly, you don't have to make reservations at KFC.
And three, pick your own spork.
Go somewhere else. Well, here in Los Angeles today, the world's second biggest media conglomerate, after Marketplace, of course.
Yes, of course.
American Public Media.
Yeah.
News Corporation is having its annual shareholder meeting. The company is already facing shareholder lawsuits over the embarrassment caused by the phone hacking scandal in the UK. And today, a group of dissident investors will be pushing for CEO Rupert Murdoch to give up some of his power. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Two big pension funds and a shareholder advisory firm are the main challengers aiming to shake up News Corp's entrenched board of directors. Charles Elson is a corporate governance expert at the University of Delaware. He says Murdoch holds sway over the biggest block of voting stock, but he'd best not ignore unhappy shareholders.
A strong enough vote against is a signal to management that something is wrong, something to which you need to respond.
Julie Tanner heads socially responsible investing for New York's Christian Brothers firm. She says Murdoch should no longer serve as both chief executive and chairman.
So the resolution asks for an independent chair of the board.
British authorities are still investigating News Corp's phone snooping, and the FBI and U.S. regulators are looking for any illegal hacking here. There's been no big hit to share value. News Corp profits are driven by its U.S. operations, largely its Fox cable TV business. But the dissenters want independent assurance their investments are secure.
What's come out so far has really not given shareholders a lot of confidence.
Confronted by hecklers the other day, Murdoch smiled and said a little controversy makes everything more interesting. Today's meeting, though, is being carefully stage-managed behind the gates of Fox Studios in Hollywood. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
A conflict between the luxury brands Christian Louboutin and Yves Saint Laurent has been reignited this week. Lawyers for Louboutin filed an appeal against a ruling earlier this year that Yves Saint Laurent could make shoes with red bottoms. That is long a Louboutin signature.
Well, in today's Midday Extra, we confront the question, can you trademark the color of a shoe or part of the shoe?
Huh.
Here to answer that question and explain the details of the case is Stacey Reardon, an attorney at Fox Rothschild in Los Angeles. Good morning, Stacey.
Good morning.
Well, first, tell us what this case was all about.
In this case, Christian Louboutin seeks to enforce a trademark, and it has filed a trademark in the United States and in France and in England on the red sole part of a woman's shoe. In general, shoes do not have trademark protection, and clothing does not have trademark protection. But he's saying the red of the sole that he puts on the shoes that he makes is special and therefore deserves trademark
protection. That color red is somehow a Louboutin exclusive?
Correct. It's a bright red, lacquered red, like a nail polish red.
So does that mean that if you had one that was just slightly a different color but still red, that you could do it or not?
No, you couldn't. In trademark law, if there's a likelihood of confusion between the two colors, then another person is prohibited from using the color red in the same spot on a shoe.
In the same spot, but it could be. I mean, what if it's mauve or fuchsia? I mean, are we splitting hairs here?
Yeah, we are. You know, with the color spectrum and some color like red, because it's one of the primary colors, you can go up and down the spectrum and a color becomes a shade off and they can become either a little more orange or a little more violet and they're all still considered red. So in the fashion world, we usually describe colors by Pantone colors. And you can actually have Pantone exclusively make you a color or a shade of red.
And that's something.
However, for trademark law, all reds are considered similar or they're likely to confuse the consumer as who makes that red.
Now, Louboutin is filing an appeal, right? Do they have a chance of winning?
Personally, I don't think so. So the case was filed in New York in the Southern District. Louboutin filed a motion for a preliminary injunction, which means they wanted Yves Saint Laurent to stop making their shoes and to pull them from all the shelves across the retailers across the United States. Louboutin lost that motion, so the judge found in favor of Yves Saint Laurent. It's very rare to appeal a preliminary injunction at this early in a lawsuit, but the judge here went so far in his ruling saying he thought Louboutin's trademark was invalid and he was prepared to take the next steps, which would be to invalidate or cancel his trademark in the red sole mark.
Stacey, I know this is a tricky area and I wonder if there's any precedent. I remember doing a story a couple of years ago about some legislation that involved like trademarking the shape of blue jeans or stuff like that. Does the fashion world have some precedent here?
The answer is yes and no. Currently, there's legislation pending in Congress that's trying to extend copyright protection to clothing. So that will give people the ability to protect the overall appearance of a garment. For blue jeans, you can trademark the logo or the pocket stitching on the back of your jeans. So Levi's has a very famous pocket stitching, or Rock and Republic has a famous pocket stitching that they enforce those kind of marks.
Now you said shape of the jeans. I'm sure most jeans are pretty much shaped all the
same.
No,
they're
not. Are they not?
You got to get into a store one of these days.
They're all different legs. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, they're hundreds of dollars.
Really? My gosh. It's not good at all.
No.
I thought khakis were like highfalutin, but apparently not, Stacey.
No, not these days.
Can the ultimate results of this case, you think, have a lasting impact on the fashion industry?
The problem with color is there's only a limited number of colors, although the shades are probably indefinite. And designers need to be able to use whatever color they want on whatever part of a garment that they want to use. And if you give one person an exclusive right to the color red, no one else can use that color. So then you're going to have shoes that if he owns red, someone may own blue and someone may own yellow. And then imagine if Reebok tries to own, you know, black for the bottom of sneakers or purple or something like that. If the trademark is upheld, I think it's going to cause chaos in the fashion industry.
Hey, Stacey, do you have any Louboutin shoes?
I have a pair or two. I do.
Uh-oh.
Guilty pleasure, I know.
Guilty pleasure.
Yeah,
the
she's
red
impressive.
Dot on the bottom, yeah. Stacey Reardon, an attorney at Fox Rothschild here in Los Angeles. We do appreciate you joining us for an interesting conversation.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Stacey.
Okay.
McDonald's said today its profit was better than expected. It made about $1.5 billion on higher menu prices in the U.S. and Europe. The earnings news comes after the company announced this week it's going to install TVs in hundreds of its restaurants featuring the McDonald's channel.
Huh.
So what kind of programming will you see? Here's Marketplace's David Gura.
It's lunchtime at McDonald's. It's busy and noisy, and it could get noisier. McDonald's partnered with ABC, BBC America, and Mark Burnett, the creator of Survivor, to start a new network. The catch is it's only watchable at McDonald's. It's debuting at hundreds of restaurants in California, but if the McDonald's channel catches on, then customers around the world might see it.
The communication will make their customers feel better about why they're at McDonald's and ultimately keep them there longer.
That's Darren Tristano, a restaurant analyst with Technomic. He says that if McDonald's can entice a customer to stick around watching music videos and local sports highlights, it might sell more McFlurries and baked apple pies. But there's another reason McDonald's is doing this. Vince Vittori is with the Yankee Group.
There is advertising opportunity.
Other companies can pay McDonald's to show their commercials to a big, captive audience.
There is definitely a opportunity to leverage the millions of visits that consumers make to McDonald's restaurants.
Supermarkets have done this kind of thing for folks in the checkout line, but this is new territory for a restaurant. Starbucks may have been the inspiration. The coffee chain got into the music business a few years ago. And now, analyst Darren Tristano says, it's a big source of revenue for the company. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
And finally today, Massachusetts lawmakers are debating a special license plate, Jeremy, for baby boomers, the generation born between 1946 and 1964, just after World War II. The tags would cost drivers an extra $30 at the DMV, and proceeds would go to this Council on Aging in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The plates have not been designed, though. There are so many ideas, though. I was looking online this morning. One radio commentator says they should feature a picture of sushi and a couple of chopsticks to highlight boomers' trendy food contributions.
Did boomers contribute sushi?
Well, I mean, we have such a wide area right there. Yes, I believe so. Another recommends the declaration, baby boomer on board. Remember those signs on the baby on board. Well, baby boomer on board. But an editorial in today's Telegram and Gazette in Worcester, Massachusetts, poo-poos any special play, Jeremy, saying baby boomers have enough vanity. They don't need a license plate to go along with it.
I'm just going to stay silent on that one.
Really? Well, you're not of the baby boomer
I'm
generation, are you?
I'm not a baby boomer, and I'm
what
just
are
gonna
you?
Keep quiet
I know about I'm a
that.
I'm a Gen Xer, which has all kinds of repercussions, but
what are the repercussions for Gen Xers?
Well, I'm not going to get into that right now. I can't say it on the radio, actually, right. But you know, well, everyone said we were slackers.
You should get a
Kurt
tag.
Cobain was the voice of my
tag.
Generation.
Are you going to put a tag on the back of your car that says Gen Xer on board?
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go get that now.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Have a great weekend. I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Updates.
And this is APM, American Public Media.